KPCW News Time is now 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. All right, let's see what we got in store for the weather this weekend. Here with the report, we have Cedric Haynes of the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday. We're going to be looking at lots of sunshine expected, just a couple of high thin clouds, so we'll call it mostly sunny skies throughout the day. If you're going to be making your way up towards the Park City area, high temperatures should warm into the upper 50s. As you get towards the Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the mid-60s. Again, lots of sunshine, so don't forget that sunscreen. As you go into your Saturday, again, lots of sunshine expected. Again, mostly sunny skies across the area. We'll be looking at those temperatures starting off around the freezing mark, but they warm up into the mid-60s for us on Saturday. In Park City, we'll see those highs climbing into the low 70s in the Heber Valley. We'll warm up even more by the time we get towards your Sunday. Highs in the upper 60s in Park City. We'll have those high temperatures into the low to mid 70s in the Heber Valley. Now, Sunday, we'll start to see some changes as a few more clouds begin to build in as a little moisture starts to sneak in from the south. And that will lead to, again, partly cloudy skies in the afternoon, but still should be mostly dry across the area. That changes as we head into your Monday. Monday is going to feature a good chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms across the area. High temperatures will climb into the upper 50s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid-60s in the Heber Valley. Your Cinco de Mayo plans, looks like we're going to have to deal with some scattered showers and thunderstorms once again popping up across the area. Temperatures once again will climb to around 60 degrees in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. Once we get you towards your Wednesday and beyond, we'll start to dry things back out again. That'll lead to partly sunny skies for us as we go into your Wednesday. High temperatures still fairly warm in the mid-60s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 70s in the Heber Valley. Just a slight chance of a pop-up shower on your Wednesday. As we go into your Thursday, look for lots of sunshine, dry conditions out there. High temperatures back to the low 70s in Park City. And we'll see those highs in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
We're going to do a little bit of local news, and then I'll be speaking with Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, about their decision to take down their paywall. Then Councilmember Tana Tolley will stop by to recap last night's city council meeting, and we will finish our hour by speaking with Weston Broadbent. He is the Wasatch Schools CAPS and CTE director. Well, Utah Governor Spencer Cox says the U.S. has an obligation to invest in data centers and artificial intelligence to protect national security. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the governor's comments come amid controversy over plans for hyperscale data centers in Box Elder County.
The Military Installation Development Authority unveiled plans April 24th for hyperscale data centers in rural Utah, its largest project yet. Some members of the public say the speed of the data center project's approval, limited opportunities for public comment, and potential environmental impacts are worrisome, as KPCW and the Salt Lake Tribune have reported. Utah Governor Spencer Cox pushed back against those concerns during his monthly news conference Thursday.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of really bad information out there about data centers. People are operating off of models and technologies that have changed drastically over the past few years, especially when it comes to water usage. That's one where the numbers are just wrong.
MIDA Executive Director Paul Morris has said the data centers will use less water than ranching and will thus be a net positive to the Great Salt Lake, an assertion Cox backed.
It's not taking additional water away from the Great Salt Lake. It's taking water that would be used for other things and using it for a different purpose now. And we have air quality standards that we have to abide by, that they have to abide by.
When asked whether MIDA's project had been rushed, Cox said residents have had their chance to provide feedback.
I'm so tired of our country taking years to get stuff done. It's the dumbest thing ever. We think that taking time makes things better or safer. It absolutely does not.
Cox said there's a national security imperative to move the data centers forward, comparing the competition to the nuclear arms race during the Cold War. The data centers, which are backed by celebrity investor Kevin O'Leary, will produce up to 9 gigawatts of energy each year. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that's more than double the power the entire state currently consumes in a year. The Box Elder County Commission will vote on MIDA's data center plans at a special meeting Monday. MIDA is a state entity created to serve the military and promote economic development. In Wasatch County, it's known for supporting Deer Valley East Village and other major projects in the Jordan L Basin. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, Top of Maine, formerly Wasatch Brew Pub, is closing for good after a 37-year run here in Park City. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the restaurant and the bar, it was the first brew pub in Utah.
Building owner Greg Scherf tells KPCW the original Wasatch Brew Pub is under contract to be sold to a New York investor as of Tuesday. The deal will close within 60 days. Scherf declined to disclose the name of the buyer or purchase price. According to employees of Scherf's tenant, known as Top of Maine since 2023, the new owners bought out and terminated their lease. The business and all its equipment has to be moved by the end of July, Scherf says. Top of Maine will still produce beer for a short time before then.
And, it was fun, but everything runs its course. And, of course, the beer industry changed monumentally.
The 73-year-old Scherf sold his stake in Wasatch Brewery, which merged with Squatter's Craft Beer in 2000, more than a decade ago. Top of Maine was his last real estate connection to the beer business. He founded Wasatch Brewery in 1986 in Park City's Iron Horse District, but state law wouldn't allow a tap room or bar. When he proposed changing that, Scherf says people thought he was crazy.
As an old hippie, when you tell somebody you can't do it, that's the motivation right there.
Park City's state legislator was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who wasn't comfortable sponsoring a permissive liquor bill. So Scherf found a bill sponsor down in Price, Utah, a Greek Orthodox Catholic named Mike Dimitrik. And in 1988, it passed. Breweries would be allowed to sell their product on site. Wasatch Brew Pub opened in 1989, a month before the first Squatters.
Years later, he said, Greg, these brew pubs are everywhere. What's going on? He goes, shouldn't we be getting some kind of royalty?
Park City Municipal hoped its new brew pub would revive Main Street. Scherf remembers half the establishments were boarded up. He says then Park City manager Arlene Lobel wanted something on the municipal land at the Top of Maine and had offered him a deal if he agreed to build it.
She said to me, get an appraisal from an established, reputable appraisal, and you can buy it from the city for half that appraised value.
The resulting building, now painted a bright blue, is tailor-made for brewing and food service. It features a grain silo built into the brewhouse ceiling, large walk-in coolers, and other specialty equipment. The Summit County Assessor estimates the land and building at 250 Main Street is worth $6.5 million. Scherf isn't sure what the new owners will do with the place.
The brew pub had a home, and locals were very generous supporting it. Every kid seems like had to do his time at the brew pub as a busser.
Scherf adds that the business would not have survived were it not for the members of the local Latino community it employed. It supported community organizations over the years, too. There used to be no Park City glass recycling, leading to one of Scherf's employees, Scott Becker, to help found Recycle Utah. In the present day, Top of Maine has partnered with the nonprofit land trust Summit Land Conservancy to brew Hop Bandit, now the clothing optional ale with wild hops. Wasatch and Squatters both have a tradition of clever or, more often, irreverent brew names. Polygamy Porter, First Amendment Lager, and St. Provo Girl Pilsner, to name a few. Some of the beer now made under the Top of Maine umbrella is also brewed at the original Squatters on Broadway in Salt Lake. But the bulk of production was in Park City. Top of Maine's bar and dining room closed for Park City's shoulder season and now will not reopen. Employees are looking for work elsewhere. It will be the second Main Street institution departing this year. Main Street Pizza and Noodle closed April 5th after a 35-year run, citing rising rent. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Joining me by phone is Lauren Gustas. She's the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. She's here to talk about the Tribune's decision to remove the paywall on its website. Good morning, Lauren. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Roger. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the end of the paywall, let's set a bit of context by talking about some Trib history. When and why did the Trib decide to become a not-for-profit after so many years as a regular for-profit newspaper?
Yeah, the Tribune just celebrated its 155th birthday a couple weeks ago. So, you know, we've been around the block a few times, family owned for a long, long time. And then we moved into, as a number of newspapers across the country have hedge fund ownership. And a family here in Utah extracted the Tribune from the hedge fund. That was the Huntsman family. Principally, Paul Huntsman did the work to extract the Tribune. And he understood that Utah was a philanthropic space. He understood that there was a lot of appreciation for the Tribune. And he thought that we had a better shot at being viable long-term if we were able to be more deeply connected and to, you know, be able to ask for that help and support from the community. So I think that was the driver of the Tribune. It was the first major metro to become a nonprofit. It did so in 2019, got its letter from the IRS, and really started behaving and acting like a nonprofit in 2020. So we've been at it for about 6 years.
You know, as we see so many local papers close and otherwise, communities lose access to local news, have other papers been able to be successfully turned into not-for-profits the way the Trib has?
That's a great question. I think because we were first, we've got a bit of a head start. So, you know, the Tribune across platforms now reaches around 21 views a month, which is a substantial reach. Obviously, you know, there are duplicates there. There are folks who are looking at us on Instagram and YouTube and sltrib.com and so on and so forth. I think a really wonderful reception here in Utah when we made the turn. However, yes, there are news organizations that have converted since we have. There are news organizations who have done it right here in Utah. So, for example, the Moab Times Independent donated itself to the Tribune, and now we operate the Moab Times Independent as a nonprofit.
Okay, so the original model, okay, when you decided to become a not-for-profit, I am sure very smart people with very detailed Excel spreadsheets mapped out what it would look like to make this thing work. And the original model was a subscription model. What's making you rethink that? First of all, did the projections come near where you hoped, and what's making you rethink it?
Yeah, you may be giving us too much credit, Roger, there with your spreadsheets. But when we became a nonprofit, there were structural things that had to change. We had to build a board, a gift acceptance policy, all the things that you all know how to do fairly well at KPCW. We had to learn. And then we focused on the journalism. We said, how does the journalism need to change? So we started doing more solutions-oriented work. You see that in the Great Salt Lake Collaborative and some of the other things we've done. And we started doing a little less of the transactional kind of crime and breaking stories of the day. But one of the things we said was, we want to lift up journalism across Utah. We want to help, to the extent that we can, build stronger communities. And if you step back and if you think about that, it's kind of hard to build stronger communities when you're gating access to information that ostensibly can help communities make better decisions. And so there were really a few folks on our staff who beat this drum for years and said, hey, we need to do this. You know, this is the right move for us. And it has taken years for us to set up the tech stack, to fundraise so that, you know, we know we're going to be okay when we make the move and so on and so forth. But it really was about, if our mission is to serve all Utahns, we're not living that mission with a paywall.
I mean, so just for the listeners who are first learning about this, you have decided to remove the paywall. What does that mean, and when will that happen?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, if trusted and independent journalism is a right and not a luxury, right, then we have to, it's on us to figure out the back end. So what it means is when you go to sltrib.com, if you go regularly, you'll be asked, you know, to pay for the privilege. When you go to sltrib.com, as we remove that paywall, you will not be asked to pay. You will be able to read as many stories as you want on sltrib, again, on sltrib.com. So we're principally talking about the online version of the paper here. We're not talking about the print product, which we still have, and we'll still ask you to pay for because there's costs associated with delivering that, with printing it, and so on and so forth. We print twice a week. We print Wednesdays, and we print a weekend edition. But for this .com product, you'll be able to access stories that have been published within the last 30 days for free. We'll ask you, you know, to register at some point so we can understand what you're reading and look to serve you maybe a newsletter that would be in alignment with what you're reading or whatnot. But it's as simple as that. We're going to remove that barrier to people being able to access the news. And we're going to do it over the course of the next couple of weeks. We're looking at early May as our launch date, but we still have some tech stack, I won't call them issues, workflows to navigate. And so we're not going to put a fine point on that date until we know we're crystal clear on that tech stack being functional.
Boy, it's the classic, wow, that doesn't seem like it would be very hard. You just got to take it off. When in fact it is, I assume, fairly complicated, particularly when it's actually going to be a new access point in the sense that it will only allow you to go back 30 days. It will be different access than existing subscribers who are paying will have. And I assume that's part of the complexity.
That's correct. We want existing subscribers who will be migrated to membership. And we'll let them know, gosh, you can opt out if you want. If you don't want to continue to support us, here's the button. But we hope that you will, right? Because by supporting us, you enable someone else to read, right? Those members will have additional benefits. So they'll be able to read the archives. They'll be able to comment on stories. We are increasingly doing events with our supporters and our subscribers. There'll be, you know, pre-invites to those. And so there's a whole suite of benefits. There's merch and so on and so forth, just like a public radio station.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that migration. I mean, right now, subscribers, you get X dollar, $6-$7 taken out of your, on a monthly basis. As you move to a not-for-profit, and you already are a not-for-profit, as you move to this model, are you going to try to encourage subscribers to bundle because it'll make it easier for them to deal with their tax benefits, or to turn it more into, I can't imagine somebody's really going to want to collect a bunch of $6 or $7 monthly contributions and turn it into the IRS. So talk a little bit about how your sort of development people are trying to make this easier, if you will.
That's a great, you use the right word. We're trying to make it as easy as we possibly can. So the vendor that we're using to build out this tech stack has added functionality such that if you donate on a monthly basis, you're still going to get that tax notification that annualizes it, right? And you get it as soon as you donate. So it comes right to you via email, right? So very, very simple. And that's the case for any donation. You will receive an acknowledgement, a receipt acknowledging your donation as soon as you make that tax deductible donation. It's automatic, right? And so again, to your point, making it as easy as possible for people. And yes, we're contacting folks now saying, hey, you've got a subscription and you donate. Thank you so much. Can we put that together for you so that there's just one receipt?
Yeah. Yeah. And are you also doing things to sort of, on the development side to sort of try to reach out and cultivate a different kind of donor base, somewhat larger donations, somewhat more sort of focused donations?
That's a great question. We're focused first and foremost on making this transition smooth for folks. And then, yes, we want to think about who we may be reaching and who we may be asking for support. We've got a very exciting pledge for the day that we go free. And we'll announce that on the day we go free, which does enable us the runway to be able to do this with confidence. But we want to make sure that we're really taking care of the folks who have been with us for a long time. And then we'll move into, how do we look to mature others?
And that sort of takes us to this new set of spreadsheets, which is you're making a decision that clearly cuts off, I don't know how many thousands of $7, is it whatever the monthly fee is.
The total digital subscription revenue that the Tribune earns now is around $2.5 million.
So you're walking away from $2.5 million. What does it look like? How do you project being able to cover that? Is it with additional advertising? Is it with additional contributions? What's the model look like?
Yeah, we hope that we're able to transition those digital subscribers to membership, right? Mm-hmm. And we've run some tests. We've had some time here, and we know how many people have dropped off and how many people haven't. So we've been able to forecast that out, right? But what we're finding is that folks are super excited about this, and folks are volunteering. They're saying, hey, I'm still going to support you. I probably get one of those notes a day. I have this question. You did this story. Where can I find this information? By the way, I've been a subscriber for 35 years and I'm still going to support you, and I get the goosebumps thinking about it, right? People, I think when you give them the opportunity to do good, they want to do good.
Well, let's talk. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you go, please.
I wanted to ask a little bit, people hear $2.5 million of revenue from the subscriber base. You have other sources of revenue, obviously, from larger donors and other things like that. Where does it all go? Let's talk a little bit about what it takes to marshal the kind of news operation that you guys really do to cover the whole state.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Well over half, I would say, probably closer to at least 2/3, if not more, of our revenue goes to personnel. Right. And for us, the product is the journalism. We do allocate significant resources to it. So, you know, before we went on air, you and I were talking about this story up in Box Elder, which is pretty wild, the hyperscale data center project, right? And we've probably thrown at least eight different folks at that story since last Thursday. And the response in the community has been tremendous, not only to that reporting, but to the county commission meetings that are going on up there. People are showing up, they're coming out, they're talking about how they feel about this project, right? And yes, when there is a big story, we are able to flex on it in a way that nobody else can. We're dissecting the parcel maps to understand who owns this land they want to build the data centers on right now. And we're finding errors in the government's data, right? And only the Tribune can do, in my opinion, that kind of work. Only the Tribune has the resources to do that kind of work because people have chosen to invest in us.
Just to give people a sense of the size of the operation, approximately how many journalists do you employ?
Obviously, yeah.
You employ lots of different kinds of people, right? It takes, yeah. Including the technical people who can figure out how to make that website work. But give us a sense of how many journalists you employ.
Yeah, so we've got about 60 to 65 folks in the newsroom, mm-hmm. and just under 100 in the organization overall. And those folks in the newsroom, that includes photographers, that includes videographers. We're increasingly making sure that as we look to combat misinformation, we're on, you know, social spaces. It includes reporters and editors, audience folks, and so on and so forth.
Okay, and how do you cover, I mean, I take it you hold yourself out, and I think you do this, as basically covering the entire state. So do you have journalists that are based in other parts of the state, or are they all out of here in Salt Lake City?
Yeah, that's a great call. No, we do. We've got journalists in the southwestern part of the state, southeastern part of the state, multiple journalists now in Moab, multiple journalists in St. George, which feels really good because there are big stories coming out of both of those communities. We have a reporter up in Cache Valley. That's not Box Elder, but it is Northern Utah, right? Mm-hmm. And we are looking, we've got a reporter in Provo, and we're looking at what we can do in Central Utah. Central Utah continues to become a pivotal player and energy and development. So that'll be kind of the next frontier for us, if you will, is Central Utah.
And based on what you said before, you obviously have some journalists in Moab, right? With the other
people. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, Lauren, anything else you want to cover? Well, actually, I have one other question I wanted to ask you. If people are interested in learning more, I mean, this is the opportunity, and learning more about possibly alternative ways to get involved with the Tribune, you know, things like donor advised funds, those kinds of sort of non-conventional, who would they reach out to?
Find me. I'm super easy to find. I'm very responsive. I'm at lgustus, LGUSTUS at sltrib.com, and I'd love to talk.
All right, Lauren, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, Roger, thank you. Hope you have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Well, joining me in the studio is Tana Tolley. We had a regular Park City Council meeting last night. She's here with a debrief. Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter. Morning, Tana.
Good morning, Roger. I'm excited to be here. It's May Day. It's a full moon in Scorpio. It's my dad and my stepmom's 25th wedding anniversary, so congratulations to them.
And you told me there was a Gaelic term for May Day.
Yes, it's called Beltane, which is a Gaelic festival that marks the beginning of summer in that tradition. It's basically the midpoint between summer solstice and spring equinox.
You learn something new every day here on the Local News Hour. Okay, Resaca, Utah came up. This has been a long time coming. Tell us what happened and where things are going to go from here.
Yes, we are really, really excited about the council moving forward with Recycle Utah. So Recycle Utah will now move in the spring to a new location, which will be out at what's called the Gilmore Parcel, which is by Home Depot. And this is a piece of property that the city owns. And so we will now move forward with deeding this property over to Recycle Utah. And then they will follow the process of going through Snyderville Planning Commission and getting their plans all set up. And then we'll move forward with having a brand new facility. And yesterday, there was a picture of showing what the difference between what we have in town right now and what we will have in the future. It is massive. I think it's like 10 times the size of what we have right now. So I am so excited for what Recycle Utah can do out there and bringing more recycling to the community.
And for those of us who are geographically visually challenged, help us place where this Gilmore parcel is. Is it near something that we would know?
It's going to be near the new High Valley. Their facility that they just put in. So it is on the frontage road if you are going out towards Home Depot. So on that frontage road.
The old 40?
The old 40, okay. Yes.
And any sense of how long it's going to take them to get from here to there?
We're hoping, I'm hoping not too long. I've talked to them in the past about what the facility is going to look like, and it's not going to be as crazy as you think of building a whole new building and it taking a couple of years. What it sounds like they can do is actually put it up in a pretty significantly shorter amount of time, because really all you're doing is mostly building a shell. There will obviously be offices and bathrooms and things like that, but I do think that we won't have a very big gap between recycling and the community.
Well, that's an interesting question. When will there will probably be a gap, though. They'll have to be out of the existing building by when?
Well, we had extended it. It was supposed to be this year, and so we've extended it until the spring of 27.
Okay. So hopefully they'll have something ready either then or soon thereafter.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go from trash to water.
Perfect.
Water came up in a couple of ways last night. One of them was a discussion, I think, of impact fees.
Yes. So we have not raised impact fees for water use for, it's going on almost 13 years, I think, 12, 13 years. And those impact fees are used for new development in the community so that it doesn't go on to the existing rate payers. And so they pay into the capital that we need to build for water. And as many people in the community know, we have this massive, amazing Three Kings Water Treatment Plant. We have 8 sources of water. We are the top of the watershed. And our water is complex, and it is part of it goes to Salt Lake, and it's a very complex system, but we do have to treat all of the water that's coming out of these mines. And so when I was a kid, you would get notices on your door that said, don't drink the water. It has antimony in it. It has, like, I don't know, arsenic in it. And so there were times when you turn the water faucet on and be like, this is black. So we've done a great job of completely turning our water system around in this community, but it's costly. And so we do want to ensure that new development pays for those as well.
And are those calculated as a flat fee per house? How do those work?
Oh, that's kind of a complex one too. It's based on, if it's commercial, if it's going to be a house, if it's a remodel, if it's irrigation, and then it's put into a calculator to figure that out. And so council is moving forward with this year. We never had an inflation calculator on it.
Okay.
And so it's going to be a really heavy one this year. So if you 2026, you're coming in, it's about a 59% increase. And then going forward, we will do inflationary increases per year.
And I take it there's been an effort to actuarially determine what the real cost is, and track that.
That's what this is.
Okay. Okay. What about rates?
So rates. So we've talked about rates since I was on council, I think, every single year. And what we're trying to do is make it predictable for the next 2 years. And so we want to stabilize the rate increases that we've had over time. And so previous councils had implemented different rate structures, and what happened this year is we had a $2.4 million deficit in water because of the way that we restructured the water rates previously. So what we're doing is we're trying to bring us back into neutral again. And so what this will do is we had it so in single family homes, so any homes, most of our homes in Park City, if they were small, medium, large, or extra large, you were all paying the same base rate. Now what we are doing is we are ensuring that homes that are larger, the bigger homes, are paying a little bit more in the base rate than the smaller ones are. And then you will hit your tier, and that's based on water usage. So the goal, and to try to make it simplified, is if you are using the water, you should be paying for the water. And we shouldn't put the burden on someone who maybe has a smaller home.
I'm struggling a little bit to understand some of the logic behind that. If I have a big home or a small home and I use the same amount of water, why would I pay more? What's the rationale there?
So it's where you hit the amount of water allocated to your specific home. So a small home, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Let's just throw these out. A small home can go to, let's say, 10,000 gallons. Mm-hmm. A larger home would be allocated at a higher amount, but they're both on the same rate. And then once they hit that rate, let's say it's 40,000 gallons at a larger home, then they're going to pay the accelerated amount in their tier. So I know it sounds a little bit more complex, but we're trying to even it out so that if you're using the water, you're paying for the water.
Okay. So ultimately the goal is to try to tie it to usage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Modest increases, I think. What are you looking at, 3-4%?
No, I mean, we're not, we're trying to get back to 4% in revenue, mm-hmm. but we're not doing it in, some people in smaller homes will actually maybe see a decrease. It's the base rate that we're changing. So, for example, everyone was paying $75 base rate. Now a extra large home, which is 1.25 acres, will pay $105.
Okay.
So that's just that difference in the base rate.
Okay. Little Kate, there's been a lot of, there was some conversation last night about a bike path there. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, so we have, we've done lots of studies on walkability and bikeability in this community. We have a Safe Routes to School program, and we have done these long-range and short-range transportation plans, and inside of them are sidewalk changes and multi-use paths and a whole plethora of other traffic calming measures. The whole purpose of this, the why to get back to, was this is to help traffic calming in that neighborhood. We lowered the speed limit to 25 about 3 years ago, but we're still seeing a high percentage of people going about 30 miles an hour. So that's like right in front of the mark. So this is the street we're talking about. So our team had come to us to talk about putting in a multi-use path similar to what you would see on the rail trail or on Willow Creek. So this idea was that it would be a 12-foot path that would be used for bikes and for walkers. Over the course of the last 3 months, we've heard a lot of feedback from the community, a lot of people who live on Little Kate who are worried more if in the walking situation, where if they're out walking their dog and an e-bike is coming up behind them, there will be this interaction between e-bikes and the walkers. And so we had a lot of community feedback via email. We had many people come out and speak last night. The part that we didn't really hear from, but I hear from all the time, are parents with kids going to school at McPullen who say right now the bike path that exists is not safe for their kids. So they don't feel safe getting their kids to school that way. So we do need to try to come up with something that makes it feel safer for kids getting to school on bikes. But there was not full support on council for the plan that was presented last night. So next week, we will continue with the bus stop improvements, because this was part of the bus stop improvement overall package that we're going out to bid for. And then we will continue to look at design and different elements for Little Kate to see if there's something we can do to improve the experience for kids and the experience for people walking their dogs as well. There wasn't a majority of council to move forward with the plan as it existed in the packet.
I want to go back and touch on something that I meant to ask you before around water. I understand you went to a ULCT conference where water was a major conference. What'd you learn?
Yeah, so that's the Utah Leagues of Cities and Towns. So it's about 600 members of our city council and our mayors and city managers together. And the theme this year is all around water. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we are the top of the watershed. So sometimes we don't think about water as something that we might not have, but we are not a self-sustaining community. We do not produce our own food, and we have a Great Salt Lake that we know is in a little bit of dire straits. We also know the Colorado River is absolutely in dire straits, and I am very fascinated about what's going on with the Colorado River and learning more about that, but this was a whole conversation about the future of the state of Utah's water consumption. And really, we are not in a great position right now. And so, you know, one of the things that people said is we really need to stop planning for the water that we hope we have and start planning for the water that we actually have. And as we know, this year was a low snowpack year, and there's going to be an effect on that. So I just like to try to get us to have this mindset that, yes, we are at the top of the watershed, but we still need to conserve water, and we are part of this ecosystem that exists in this state and exists in the western states, and we really need to be cognizant of that.
What would you like to see the city do going forward with respect to managing waters? I know last week we had someone on to talk about the landscape program where you can get a subsidy if you basically zero-scape your front yard.
Yeah.
What else? What would you like to see the city do?
I mean, there are places around the western states that are going a lot more extreme than that. You know, we have to have a balance between preserving the Great Salt Lake and the development that's coming as well. And so I personally pulled out all the grass in my yard. I know that people are very attached to their yards and their grass, but I think we all need to be a little bit more understanding of how quickly this world is changing. I mean, I honestly do not think that the world that exists today will exist in 3 years when I'm up for re-election or off of council. I think we'll be in a whole different place. So we really need to think about what's important to us. And I think that, you know, those are things like like what's happening with AI and what's happening with climate. And so I would like us to actually get more serious and more conservative about conserving water.
It'll be interesting to see how you try to implement that in the months going forward.
It will be.
All right. Last week I had Kendra Wyckoff on. And from Peace House, because, you know, Peace House had gotten this great, really significant new federal grant. While we're certainly lucky to have those resources, what's your take on the uptick in domestic violence in this community?
Yeah, you know, I'll get probably a little emotional here, but I think that sometimes Park City, well, not sometimes, I was born and raised here, so I think I can say this, but we live in a bubble, and we sometimes see these things at national levels that we don't think are really affecting us. And so, you know, those are everything from what's happening with ICE to the Epstein files to, you know, anything you can think of is we're actually starting to see things like that trickle down into our community. And I am a big supporter of the Peace House. I volunteered there in college when it was just right up here on MARSAC, and it's always been something that's really near and dear to me. And, you know, talking to Kendra, in the last 9 months, they've had a 40% increase in women and children coming in. And we should, just like recycling, like we want to see, or like shouldn't compare it to that, but like we want to see less. We don't want to see more for this, right? So they had 182 women come in the last 9 months. And one of the things that's, you know, heartbreaking for me to hear is these women leave there and they don't have resources of where to go. And so we don't offer a lot of that in our community. And so what I would really like to see is for us as a city to be able in our, in the different housing developments that we're putting in as a city, that we offer something to women and children who are going through this transitional time. And so that's been some conversations I'm having with her. And, you know, I'm just going to bring this up, and it's really hard to say, but she said, you know, there's a lot of, they're seeing a lot of people come in with like strangulation and just things that are like really, really heartbreaking. And so I know we life is seems so great here, but there are people in our community that are really going through some really tough stuff. And I really want to be able to, as a city councilor and as the city, move forward in helping that way.
Before we go, Tana, there's been a group of residents who are sort of marshaling arguments that the 5-acre parcel should, instead of being developed, be a park. Is that anything that's likely to have an impact on how the city reacts going forward?
Well, it was approved by council. So at this point, we did actually have some public comment about it last night. It is a mixed-use development. It is not just a housing development. So it has open space, arts and culture, commercial, and residential. And now the process will go to Planning Commission, and Planning Commission will look at it from a zoning and code perspective. And that's when the public actually can come out and there's more public hearings about it. But the decision from council to move forward was made about a month ago. And so at this time, I have not seen anyone on council bring up that we should go back and revisit that decision.
Okay, Tan, anything else you want to touch on before we go on this beautiful May Day?
Yeah, I just wanted to, we did enact a fire ban last night. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, wildfire is something that we really want to ensure people are cognizant of. So that's the firework on open ignition, I think is the right word. And then firework ban. And then next week at our council around 4 p.m., we'll have a work session with the chief of the fire department, and he'll come in and talk to us about wildfire prevention for the summer.
Okay, Tana, thanks for spending time with me.
Thanks, Roger.
Well, school board meetings often focus on routine matters like personnel, building maintenance, and curriculum. But on Tuesday, Weston Broadbent, the Wasatch School District CAPS and CTE director, made a different kind of presentation. One that focused on employee housing. He's on the phone to tell us about it. Good morning, Weston, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Well, sir, so let's talk about this. Why is housing a concern that the board felt the need to address?
So that's a great question. And to answer that question, the core of the issue is housing is an issue across the nation, as we all know. But in the Wasatch Bag, Park City, Heber, we are pricing some of our educators from living back in the Wasatch Bag, and we want our educators to live in our communities as much as we can. So that's kind of part of the core of why we're addressing it.
Okay, and obviously the board saw the need to address it, and they sort of engaged this concept of doing a needs assessment. Tell us about that process. What did you guys do?
So the needs assessment. So, and maybe I need to back up a little bit.
Okay.
We have a home building program in our school district where our students build houses.
Mm-hmm.
And because our students build these houses, we build a house once a year, and our students, there's this huge demand in the Wasatch Back where we have the trades begging for students to come out and get involved in the trades and become electricians or plumbers or general contractors. And so there's this demand. And so we have this opportunity for our students to go and build houses. And so as part of this process of building a house once a year, we build these houses and then we turn around and sell them to our teachers at the cost that we're into it.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of it is twofold. We give students an awesome educational experience, and then we also turn around and we sell a home at an affordable rate to keep an educator in our valley. And so we've been doing this for a few years now, and as time has gone by, there's been this need to understand what is the real housing needs that we have in our district, and where are our employees living, and what are they affording, and who's renting, and who owns, and all that. So that was kind of the background of a lot of this discussion.
So that's really interesting. So the fact that you had this sort of curriculum, this teaching experience of selling a home a year sort of gave rise to this further inquiry. So then how do you go about doing this needs assessment? What did you guys look at, and what sort of was the methodology?
So that's really a great question. The way we did it was we just sent it out to our employees, and we built had some AI help in creating a needs assessment of what should be included and what shouldn't be included in that, and refined it. And then in 2023, we sent it out to all of our employees and had, I think, like a 40% response rate. And then this year, so 3 years later, we sent it out, and so we could start seeing kind of a trend. And we got some interesting data that came out of it. And as we got the responses this year, we got, I think it was like a 35% response rate. And so, again, both of them super significant or statistically significant. And so we're pleased with the data, and we feel like it's real data that we can make some decisions off of.
So let's do some sort of benchmark math, for lack of a better term. I think there's a lot of studies that talk about what percentage of your income should be spent on housing. So I take it one of the things you're trying to figure out is the relationship between teacher compensation and what it's costing them to house, and is there a sustainable model there? Am I on the right track there in terms of what you have to think about? Talk to us about what you learned here.
Super, and that's a really deep question that's a really insightful question. And so the general rule of thumb for years and years, and our mortgage guys don't agree with this in today's market, but the general rule of thumb is that the cost, we call it, who knows who calls it what, but the cost burden is what we call it the cost burden of your housing, right? And so if you make $100,000 a year, you shouldn't be spending more than 30% of your income on your housing. Is the general rule of thumb, 30%.
Okay.
So 30,000 shouldn't be, you shouldn't, over that, the course of the year, you shouldn't go over it. But it is pretty rare with today's interest rates and real estate prices, for our mortgage guys, the community members that we know and trust, they were telling me that that is a pretty hard number to hit in today's market. But I still feel that with our board and with this needs assessment, that's kind of the number. We based it all off of 30%.
And what did you learn about what percentage of your faculty or your employees were able to get close to that number?
Well, that's a really good question, too. Let me
I'm gonna cheat for you because I've got the key findings in front of me.
And I'm like you probably have it right there. I'm like, let me make sure I get some real numbers.
But I want to talk about what it means, because the first finding that I saw, it says 26.1% of respondents spend more than 30% of their income on housing, up from 19.8% in 2023. I think that's a little bit scary. I mean, obviously, the district has to find a way to attract and retain its teachers, and this looks like a pretty scary set of numbers to me.
And that was the concern 3 years ago, is we could feel that was the trajectory that we were headed on. And Park City has been dealing with this longer than we have. Park City's real estate prices have increased faster than Wasatch County's, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So historically have been higher. And so Park City has a significant amount, and I don't know the exact number, but they have higher percentage of their teachers coming in from outside of the Park City market to come and be educators. And so our concern was, in fact, to the point where Park City had to implement some sort of a stipend for driving in or some sort of a desire to help attract teachers to come into their market. And so we could see the real estate prices rising in the Heber Valley and wanted to try to get ahead of that. And so although the numbers aren't surprising, they're also not encouraging for keeping educators in our valley.
And of course that sort of segues into the next finding, which was a lot of people are thinking about leaving.
Yeah. Well, and I think that one's a little skewed.
Okay.
Honestly, I feel like that one's based off of who would be interested in moving in the next few years,
right,
was the question.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know a lot of teachers who are, you know, looking to move because of the stage of life, you know, they're having kids,
right,
they're empty nesters or whatever. So that one I actually feel like was not as significant as what we found.
I know that South Summit was exploring the actual building of almost a housing development on school-owned land.
Yes, they were.
And
It was like a year or two ago. They were pursuing that. Yeah.
I don't know what's happened to that. But what kinds of things are you guys thinking about in terms of, obviously, you've identified a need here. Where do we go from here?
So there's lots of ways that this could go. And there's rental needs. There's home ownership needs. If you look through the assessment, it is by far and away, most people would prefer to still have home ownership at some point, right? It's kind of one of the findings through this survey. But one of the directions we would like to go in order to, part of this construction, our home building program where our students are learning the trades, is we bought a few lots from Mountainlands Community Trust that has a subdivision called Parkview Place in Heber, and we had four lots, and we've got one more lot to build on next year. And then our lot prices are fairly expensive in this valley.
Yes.
As you would imagine. And so we're looking at, we own some land next to one of our middle schools, Timpanogos Middle School. And we're considering the idea of doing a educator subdivision for our home building program, where we just continue that program on and probably shrink the house sizes a little bit more than what we've built, and so that it's more affordable with the interest rates of today that our teachers could afford, but have, you know, 30-ish type lots maybe in there. And anyway, that's one of our potential, and we know that that's a drop in the bucket. I mean, we're building one home a year with that program, so it's not like we're solving the problem overnight. But again, many hands make light work is kind of the idea, and this would be one of those potential solutions that would make a difference. And
you've seen Habitat do projects like that around the country, so that's a really interesting model. And again, you'd have to explore rental versus ownership. Lots of open questions when you're talking about doing something like that. We got about 30 seconds left. Tell me, where do you think the process is going to go from here? Is this going to come up again for further discussions at the board level?
Yeah, Well, there's a lot of things in the works on this, on making it happen. It's in the county, and so we've had some discussions with the county on getting it the density that we would need. And obviously, there's not a profit margin for us. This is strictly to keep our workforce housing people in our valley. So we're going to be working with the county, getting their input, working with our board, getting their input, and in the end, hopefully, come up with a project that benefits our educators and ultimately the students and the families that live in this valley.
Weston, I hope you'll come back and talk to us some more about things as it develops. Thanks for spending time with me this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye, Weston. Thanks.